disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This flat earth. Is the earth flat? I typed that question into Google, curious as to what websites would come up in the search results. Google quickly came back with an answer at the top of the page. The answer is, I quote, "No, the earth is roughly a sphere." Try it for yourself. Google doesn't normally provide answers in this way though, which is interesting. I'm asking this question while conducting research into the Flat Earth movement. You see, I have an interview lined up for tonight's show, and it's with one of the most prominent names in the Flat Earther movement. I invited him onto the show as I was curious. Curious about how such a large group of people could so vehemently believe and champion a theory that science has disproven for over 2,500 years. It's a theory that's also growing in popularity. Over the last decade or so, individuals claiming to support the idea that our planet, planet Earth, is indeed flat and not a sphere, has grown in prominence, especially in the online community. Those of you who are regular listeners of the show will know that we place scientific evidence over all else. It's due to this viewpoint that I have always found the theory of a flat Earth particularly difficult to digest. There is just so much evidence to disprove it. Not only that, the evidence is easily accessible. You don't have to research if the Earth is a spherical globe. You don't have to study the works of a particular scientist. You can conduct simple high school level experiments yourself, and within minutes, you have your answer. If the Earth was flat, we would be able to look out and see very far, assuming that there were no buildings in the way or mountains, of course. We could see another city that's hundreds of miles away, or a ship sailing out to sea. The ship would stay in view no matter how far out to sea it went on a flat plane. However, it doesn't. If we look out when standing on the ground, we can't see that far. We can't look out into the distance and see a town that's miles and miles away. And the ship will slowly start to disappear from view as it gets further away. This is because the Earth is round. Things in the distance are not visible because there is a curve to the landscape. We can test this another way too, by watching the sunset. Simply find a spot where you can see the sunset, and also have a place close by where you can safely move higher, such as a tall building. From your vantage point on the ground, the sun will eventually disappear beyond the horizon. As soon as this happens, quickly ascend to the top of the higher building that you selected. From there, you'll be able to see the sun again for a brief time. Due to the Earth's curvature, you are able to see further over the horizon at a higher level, thus seeing the sun again. If that alone doesn't convince you, then consider this free and easy experiment. During a lunar eclipse, the Earth will pass between the moon and the sun. We know this. This is science. When this happens, the sun projects the Earth's shadow onto the moon. And when that happens, you can actually see the Earth's shadow if you look up at the moon. You will see that there is a round shadow, not a flat one. A sphere. A flat earther's rebuttal might be whether the earth could be flat and round, like a pancake. Could this not cause the shadow of the moon to be round whilst the shape of the earth is still flat? Well, the short answer is no. If the earth was flat, but rotating, then its shape would be different for eclipses that occur at different times of the day or night. Sometimes it would appear as a line. Some of the time it would appear like an oval or a circle as it's spinning. However, we know that the shadow the Earth casts on the Moon during an eclipse has always been circular, regardless of the time of day, week, month or year. This can only support the idea that the Earth is a sphere. But my purpose here is not to rebuke their argument. Far from it, I respect those with differing views to mine, as I firmly feel that discourse is key to progression. That said, believing the world to be flat isn't like a belief in ghosts whereby there is no solid evidence either for or against the theory. It's more akin to saying the sky appears to be red rather than blue, or the speed of light isn't 186,000 miles per second, it's actually 20 miles per second. What I mean by this is that claiming that the Earth is flat is disputing thousands of years of scientific evidence and research in favour of something that you have a feeling to be true. Although, from my research into the subject, I'm not so sure that science is the focal point of deliberation amongst flat earthers. I think the theory of being a flat earth is more a question of conspiracy and psychology. I'm going to ask you to keep that in mind while we go into our interview now, and we'll return to this subject shortly. So, we have a really special guest on the show tonight, and I'm really honoured that he could spare us some time. He's an expert on the flat earth theory and has written a number of books on the subject, which are all available on Amazon. He fronts a YouTube channel called Flat Earth Clues, which, at the time of writing this, has amassed over 10 million views and has almost 100,000 subscribers. He is also the subject of a Netflix documentary titled Behind the Curve, which is a fantastic watch if you get the opportunity, and I highly recommend that you check that out. His name is Mark Sargent, and he's joining us from his home in Seattle, Washington, in the United States. Mark, hello. How are you doing?
I am doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And thank you for coming on the show tonight. I appreciate that it was short notice for yourself.
Happy to do it. Happy to do it.
So, obviously, we want to talk about the Flat Earth Theory. I believe it was the LA Times that called you the main organizer for the Flat Earth movement. So, really, what I want to establish first is this. You hold genuine belief that the planet Earth is flat and that all evidence to the contrary is false. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, that is true. And it's not just flat, it's also enclosed. You're living in a box, a giant building, a planetarium, a terrarium that is so old and so large that even our best and brightest didn't figure it out till almost 1960. And that would be the Americans and the Soviet Union at the time. And when they did, they decided to keep it under wraps. And by that, I mean a building. With inside that building is a giant saltwater lake. And in that lake are a bunch of islands, which we know as the continents. And the only thing that doesn't look exactly, well, more or less like the continent layout that we know now, the shapes and sizes of the continents, would be Antarctica. So Antarctica isn't this island nation that lives, that's about the same size as Australia. It is stretched out around the entire outer boundaries and is the beginning of the end. So the Antarctic coastline wouldn't be the edge of Earth. It's not like Asgard. It's not like a cosmic waterfall thing. But that's the starting of it. And once you went in thousands of miles, eventually you would run into some sort of barrier. So yes, that's what I believe. And yes, to make it even more clear, no, I do not think we are this tiny little rock covered with a little bit of water and even a smaller amount of smoke or gas inside this vast, massive, impossible universe. I think it's very contained and very structured.
Okay, that's very interesting. So you mentioned there about the Antarctic coast that runs around the rim of the Earth's edge. So do I assume that there is some kind of ice wall that keeps everything in, everything contained, if you will?
To use one of my peers, when they say, "Oh, why does the water fall off?" We hear that a lot. It's the standard, and it's like, okay, I get it. The old illustrations of the water falling off because people can't escape that because they keep thinking of space. That's the big thing. I'm saying, look, you're in a building that's probably sitting on somebody's desk right now. Right. But the question is, why doesn't the water fall off? It's like, okay, why doesn't a water fall off in a lake? It's because it's got a shoreline all the way around it. So there is a wall. I mean, the Antarctic coastline is mostly a sheer wall of ice. It's only a couple hundred feet high. But what's more interesting about Antarctica, and the general public doesn't know this, is that Antarctica slopes up very, very quickly, and most of the continent, even by mainstream standards, sits at about 14,000 feet, making it really unusual compared to every other landmass we have. You got to remember, altitude sickness kicks in at about 7,000 feet. And most of this continent, it's like about 14,000, and some are even higher. Nah, it's the whole place just screams go away.
At what point did you discover or start believing in this theory then? When did you realize that this was a flat earth and not what the science community had led us to believe?
It was, I got into it initially in 2014. Because I never got married or had kids, and I'm older, I'm in my early 50s now. And because of that, if you don't ever get married or have kids, you have a lot of free time on your hands. And because I was older, I was also there when the internet was just firing up and the conspiracy world and the truther community was getting going. And so I had plenty of time to look at just about every conspiracy you could think of. And I have an opinion on just about every conspiracy you can think of. Some I like, some I don't. I try to keep it as positive as possible. And my qualifier, just so you know, for any conspiracy is, could I improve on it? Meaning I don't look at the conspiracies like, oh, this is evil and sinister and the Illuminati must be stopped. Nothing like that. I say is, okay, why are they doing it? And I believe in the greater good, always have, which is if the ends justify sometimes horrible means, does that make sense? And if it does, then it's like, oh, yeah, it's probably real then. Because, you know, people in power tend to be of the moral flexibility type. Anyway, so I got into this after looking through all these different conspiracies. In the middle of 2014, I was looking into Hollow Earth because I'd never looked into it. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Got tied into Admiral Byrd, Richard Byrd, the youngest admiral in the United States Navy, who was the first guy to fly his own plane around the North Pole. And then for whatever reason, that whole storyline changed and the military sent him down to Antarctica. And he flew basically nonstop missions for the next 30 years, from 1928 up until his death in 1957, I believe. And it was just incredible. So what got me was, you know, what flipped me was was Antarctica in terms of the treaty. Because every other treaty, I don't care what country you're in, has been broken over time, with the exception of one. And that's the Antarctic Treaty. I mean, treaties are meant to be broken. This one, not only has it never been broken, it's never been challenged. And you can look it up. The PDF is online. It's been on there. It was first ratified, I believe, in 1959. And all the nations that were down there had to sign on to it. And it basically said, no corporation from any country can set up shop there forever. And that just threw up huge red flags for me. I'm a student of history. And it's like, look, this world is built, especially in the capitalist, you know, countries. It's built on money and greed and power. Plain and simple. When Admiral Byrd went on television, national television here, and he said that the entire Antarctica is made out of money, right? There's a mountain range made out of coal, and there's uranium, and there's oil and gas reserves and all this stuff. And we're going to be fighting over, disputing this for the next 100 years. And then a couple years later, they said, they start working on paperwork saying, yeah, nobody should ever go down there ever. Let's not talk about it. What blew me away was not that the corporations can't go down there, but they can't even talk about it. So British Petroleum, for example, wanted to run full-page ads in the London Times, you know, back in the day, and say how great it would be for us to expand our energy empire and do this. They never did it. You somewhere along the line, the higher ups talked to the, you know, presidents of these companies and made them sign non-disclosure agreements and said, oh yeah, no one could go down there. It's national security. You're not even allowed to talk about it. That's it. Have a nice day. And that's huge. I mean, anyone in the truther community is like, look. There are very few issues that are bigger than money. I mean, money was an old movie line. 9 out of 10 problems in the world revolve around money. This is one of those things that's so big, they said, you know what? The trillions of dollars in resources, not even on the table anymore. And so that was the big thing that flipped me, then that there was something being hidden that was tied into, you know, the world being a big and closed system.
What is your background in, Mark, professionally? I understand that you either are or were previously a software engineer. Is that correct?
I started out, believe it or not, playing video games for a living. Back in the day. I won a little video game tournament back in 94 and parlayed that into a software gig where I was a ringer, first of all, for this gaming company out in Colorado. And went around to all the conventions, and then I became a game producer for the same company where I was recruiting guys, you know, software developers and graphic artists and music guys, and putting them all together, and that was a lot of fun. And then the video game industry started changing, started getting really, really big, and this company just couldn't keep up. So I jumped over to time and attendance software. And if you want to call it a software analyst, that's fine. I was mostly in high-level support. I was doing a lot of beta testing, And not engineering, but I was doing sales engineering. So I would work with the sales guys, and, you know, because they want to sell the software a certain way. But time and attendance software, which is basically timekeeping software, is so broad and so complex potentially, that what really helped me was I had to take this really, really broad software package and I had to boil it down for every company that I went to. I traveled around the country and sometimes outside the country and installed in blue collar factory environments, these time clock systems, and I would train the people on how to use them. And I got very good at boiling down complex things into what you should know, the lowest common denominator. And I did that over a number of years, and it's how I think now, to where I can look it up. I look at just about any subject and I say, okay, stop making it too complex. What is the basic thing? So when, like, for example, the flat earth, the flat earth is just the term. That's the lowest denominator I can bring out there. Most of the time I love to tell people, it's like, look, it's probably virtual. If it's flat and it's enclosed, it's probably digital. You know, the whole Matrix 13th floor thing, that's what I really believe in, but the general public can't grasp that. The Matrix is, what, 22 years old now? And most of the people didn't get it. It's like, oh, yeah, they got the special effects and a cool storyline and very, very, very slick. But they didn't understand the concept. Or the 13th floor, which was based on a 70s movie from Germany, called World on a Wire, which was based on a 60s book called Simulacron 3, Simulacron Simulation. Anyway, sorry, I'm going off into the weeds here.
The reason I ask about your background, Mark, is because you were clearly an educated gentleman. And also, in the Netflix documentary that you were part of, I believe there was an astrophysicist from Caltech who was interviewed, and she shared your flat Earth theory. Now, typically, those who believe in this theory are derided or maybe called cranks and so on. What do you feel when people say that about you, Mark?
Oh, no, I don't. In fact, I have been known to say many, many times, if you don't laugh at this thing in the first 20 minutes, there's probably something wrong with you. Flat Earth, the conditioning for people, everybody, is so strict and so deep that your reaction has to be, the five stages of acceptance, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. The first instinct is always denial. Including me, it was like, no, there's no way. There's no freaking way. Why? Well, because that's what we were told, which is why I love the wonderful George Orwell quote from 1946, I believe, where, in fact, do I have that line around here? I think I do. Let me read it verbatim. Which is, he said, it was written 1946 in the Tribune, number 27. Most people, and he was not a flat earther, by the way, most people, if asked to prove that the earth is round, would not even bother to produce the rather weak arguments I've outlined above. They would start off by saying that everyone knows the earth to be round, and if pressed further, would become angry. In a way, Shaw is right. This is a credulous age, and the burden of knowledge which we now have to carry is partly responsible. And what he was saying is that science gets away with murder now. Basically, if you wear a lab coat and you have any sort of credentials at all, you can say whatever you want, and the general public's going to believe you. And they'll say, it's like, well, this person obviously knows more than me, therefore I should believe him. The bigger question was, in 1946, how did everybody know the world was a globe? How did everybody know? NASA wasn't even founded until 1958. There were no space missions, not even close. So how did everybody know? And when you put it to them, there's this, the wheels start grinding in the average person, which is, it's not that they know, it's they've been told. And there's very different things there, which is why I put out the challenge to people. I say, look, if you think you see, I have had so many people, thousands and thousands and thousands of people that have told me, I've seen the curve from an airplane. Okay, great, fine, take a picture of it. Put it on your laptop or your screen or whatever and hold a straight edge and tell me if that curve's still there. If it is, send it to me. I will quit Flat Earth tomorrow. No one has sent me anything. Now, of course, I've never gotten any apologies emails either, but that's okay. Again, it's not that they see it. And again, this is straight out of Orwell, which is, it's not that they see it. They want to see it. Again, very, very different things. It's five lights, four lights. You are told there's a curve over and over and over and over and over again since you were 6 years old. And then also, what happens, when somebody challenges us, it's like, well, it's a curve. In fact, in our country, for example, I can't speak for you guys, which is, we have the American flag in the corner of every classroom. And if you make it from kindergarten to graduation, just high school graduation, there are people that join the military partially because they see that flag up in the corner. Well, right below that flag in most classrooms is the globe. But what's the difference? Right? You know, look up at the flag. It's like, oh, that's where I live, right? You look down at the globe. It's like, oh, that's where I live. Well, the problem is that the flag, that actually represents a country you're actually in. The globe, that's just a little toy model that nobody's ever seen, you know, not from space. Anyway.
So do you think that the accepted science and those that support that science of the Earth being a globe are part of a conspiracy? What do you think the aims of that conspiracy are, and who do you think is involved exactly?
Like any conspiracy, most of it's around control and power. You know, information is the most powerful thing there is out there. Forget about money and other resources. It's information. If you know the outcome, I mean, look at the wonderful Rothschild story about how they knew what the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo was, for example, before the British government did. And because of that, you know, the stock market, you know, they spread the rumor, the stock market crashed, then the real information, it's like, oh no, the British actually won. And then it's like, but they had cornered the market at that point. They had bought all the stocks when they were really, really low. So when we're talking about power here, think about this, because people have asked me, in fact, what was the most famous one? I'll drop a name for you. Piers Morgan asked me that very question. And he says, you know, he goes, why keep it a secret? Why not tell people? I go, and I asked him, I go, really? Would you break this story? Would you tell people? And think about that for a second. Because the ramifications, by the time you figure it out, now if telling people hundreds of years ago, that's one thing. You can mold society and civilization to your liking. But if you don't even know we'll just call them the Illuminati, right? There's so many different groups. I'm not going to say who's at the top of the food chain. I don't know. But if you're in a big Illuminati meeting and in 1960, when civilization has already been built, you know, the cement has hardened, the paint has dried, do you tell the general public? Do you release it to the general public, given that this is some of the most valuable, if not the most valuable piece of information in our history? Well, somebody says at the end of the table, well, what could go wrong, right? Three things could go wrong, and they're disastrous, which is, first off, the academic world would be in utter upheaval for decades. You know, think about it. Astrophysics and astronomy, they're gone pretty much forever. You have to rename them. You don't even know what to do with those. And the remaining physical sciences, geology, hydrology, archaeology, biology, anything with an ology has to be rebuilt. Libraries have to be emptied. It's just chaos. And that's every university in every country. That's a lot of academia. Economics, the world markets have to close for months because you don't know what it means. You know, the ramifications there are huge. But the big one, the really, really big one, the dangerous one is the religious aspect, because you're giving the five major religious houses of this world, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity, you're giving them all leverage against science, and you're asking them to show restraint against science, even though science has been beating them over the head with textbooks for the last five centuries. And that would not go well, because those people would then turn on science and say, okay, you were really wrong about something important. What else were you wrong about? Let's revisit some things like, I don't know, evolution, carbon dating, the Big Bang theory, dark matter. I don't know, anything that we see in your books. Science would never recover. Between those three things, that's one of the shortest Illuminati meetings ever. They're like, it's like, you know, you just like, what could go wrong? And then somebody rattles off that stuff. It's like, okay, we're not going to tell anybody until we can figure out how to best use it to our benefit. And they held on to the secret, you know, since about 1960. And for whatever reason, they're allowing this to get out now. And I mean, what I mean allowing is our community was running pretty much unchecked for 3 years and change, from 2015 to 2018. We were getting promoted by all the big tech. We're getting promoted by all these different things. You know, every major YouTube channel has done a Flat Earth video at some point because they saw the metrics. It's like, holy smokes, you do a Flat Earth video, not only do your hits double, but your comment section goes up like 1,000% because people are so polarized about it. So something's, I don't know why we're being allowed to do this. There's something else coming though. I know, who knows, maybe we're in the middle of it right now, but Flat Earth seems to be the picture frame for a much, much bigger canvas.
Have you ever been questioned or challenged by anyone in authority? Like, has anyone accosted you for spreading disinformation or anything?
The question, which is, have anyone ever reached out to me with either the carrot or the stick, I think is what you're getting.
Absolutely.
No, but that doesn't help me most of the time, because people think, oh, Mark's getting away with it because, you know, I've been called a government agent a number of times. because I don't get challenged. But at the same time, it's like, nah, it's not what you might think, because I also put myself in a position where you can't really, there's not much you can do in the way of leverage. What are you going to do? I mean, I never got married and never had kids. My circle of friends is in the community. So, and this is what I do for a living, at least until the pandemic happened, this is what I was doing. So there's no black car has ever followed me. No one's ever approached me with a briefcase, you know, two briefcases, usually a pile of money in one and a gun in the other to make the point. Kind of like what they did with Joe Rogan, which was, you know, Joe was a great example of what could happen, which was, you know, he was beating the crap out of NASA on a regular basis, and he was not a flat earther. And then all of a sudden he was winning, and he goes dark for like a year. And when he comes back, he had a brand new show, at least a 1-year contract on Science Channel called Joe Rogan Questions Everything. And the very first episode, he apologized publicly for everything bad he ever said about NASA. Not suspicious at all from our community standpoint. And then he gets the biggest podcast in the world after that, after the show ran out. I was like, okay. But he's been known. I mean, you know, what was it? Alex Jones even said during one of his little off camera things where because he's good friends with Joe Rogan. He said, oh yeah, they got to him. You know, because again, they will usually use the carrot and the stick simultaneously. They'll say, you take the money, you'll live the good life. But if you don't take the money, we'll ruin you or do horrible things. Anyway, there you go. Sorry, long-winded answer.
You mentioned there about your circle of friends and how they're all part of the movement. Do you ever think you could be friends with someone who had alternative viewpoints or the standard spherical Earth stance, for example?
Sure. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've got lots of friends that aren't in the community, but my closest friends are in it, because again, this is what I've been doing for 6 years. You know, between the conventions and the meetups and all the online things we've done over and over, it's a very, very tight community. We're always knowing what's going on and always keeping track of each other, because we're very information hungry. We're always trying to figure out what, you know, it started out with, okay, what new things are people doing? What new experiments? What new discoveries in different places? So we're always like, okay, what's happening? What's happening? What's happening? So because of that, you know, the group is pretty much, I know, you know, like I tell people, like if anyone needs to get a hold of somebody in our community, if I don't know how to track them down immediately, I definitely know someone who does.
I just want to jump back a little to something you said early on in our conversation, if I may, Mark. This is kind of an existentialist question, I suppose. But from what you have said, we live on a flat disk within a dome. What do you think is outside that dome? Are we an experiment? Who controls us? Who created us? That kind of thing. Do you have any of that information?
Yeah. It's a good question, and I love answering it, which is, it can only be one of two things. Either, because again, why the religious angle? Why 50%, by the way, of our membership are at least in the United States, are strong Christians. Because if it was built, if you're living in basically a snow globe, then it was built by someone, which means it was created by someone. And that point, okay, you fork off into one of two places, which is either an older civilization, which is more powerful than and more advanced than ourselves, or the divine. And really, then you're kind of splitting hairs, aren't you? Because really, one man's advanced tech is another man's deity. So that's as far as goes, you know, who built it. As far as what's outside this place, I like to think of it as the opposite of what's in this place. This world, if you stare at it long enough, and get part of my software background, you stare at something long enough, you will start to see patterns, especially the subtle nuances is what I love, which is this world is 99.99% conflict. It is practically inescapable. Meaning it doesn't matter how rich, how powerful, how beautiful, how talented you are, there is always something in conflict. There is always something to complain about. You know, everyone tries to strive. It's like, oh, you know, your role models are all these people that at this high level. It's like, no, they've got serious problems. There was a wonderful story from years and years ago. One of our early millionaires, Getty. Back in the day in America, and he had this like 110 room mansion, for example, you know, just a little place, and he ripped out all the phones in the mansion because the guests kept making long distance calls and he replaced them with payphones in the hallways. Right? It's like, you know, the guy has more money than a pharaoh, and that's what he thinks about. Right. But my point, you kind of get it, right? So if this world is 99.99% conflict, then what's outside of here has to be 99.9% unlimited. And which also would mean it'd be potentially cyclical. If you want to get into the existential side of things, I use the genie and the million wishes story, which I came up with years ago, which was, okay, a genie comes to you, you rub the lamp, get three wishes, but you're smart. So you think, oh, one of my wishes is going to be a million wishes. Don't ever do that because you'll never make it. And you start wishing for stuff. You go through all these things. You know, most people, again, general public, always wishes for money first. It's like, no, go for immortality, perfect health, superpowers, whatever you want. Don't wish for money first. Anyway, you go through all your wishes and you start running out of things to wish for, right? To where, I mean, you've been the rock star, you've dated everyone you ever wanted to date, you become whatever you wanted to become, and you run out of days. I believe, on a side note, that the part of this universe runs off of novelty. And meaning, what's new? It's one of the things we always say, right? When we bump into each other, what's new? We thrive on it. We just start going crazy if we don't get novelty. And I think that's the same no matter where you go. So anyway, you run through all these wishes. At the end, you come back to the genie. The genie's kind of looking at you, smirking. And he's like, you're out of ideas, aren't you? It's like, yeah, man, I am totally out of ideas. I've been living for, 10,000 years, done all these things. And it's like, can you help me out? He's like, well, yeah, I can do something for you. He goes, I got this place you can go to. Limited lifespan, a million ways to die, lots of suffering. You're going to hate it. However, it's like, why would I want to go there? It's like, because when you go there, once you leave and come back, this place will be brand new again. And you can do this. It's a refresh more than anything. It'll change your perspective. It'll give you more appreciation for where you are. And you look and it's like, wow, it sounds pretty great. What's the catch? Because the catch is, you're never going to remember we had this conversation. And he snaps his fingers. Voila, you're here.
I think I recall, again, from your Netflix documentary, that there's another gentleman in the Flat Earth movement, and he makes fairly large models of the Earth in flat format. It's got like a glass dome over it. The models have a small sun and a moon on a rotating axis at the top of the dome, which rotates within it, simulating day and night in various parts of the Earth and so on. But how do you explain things like other planets, galaxies, stars, and so on that we can view from Earth?
Oh, just lights in the sky. But before I answer that, let me say that all the illustrations that show the snow globe with the sun and the moon overhead, they are exaggerated. The problem with it, because of the question I thought you were initially going to ask, it's like, how do we have time zones if the sun is shining light all the time? It's because when they draw the sun, because they have to make it show up in the illustration, they have to draw it about a couple thousand miles wide. Or we say, no, the sun is just a freaking pinpoint. It's like 50 miles wide. Very, very, very small. And same with the moon, which is why they're identical, why the moon fits in front of the sun. But as far as everything else in the sky, it's no different than a planetarium. And I know that dates me. Hardly anyone knows or goes to a planetarium anymore. But when you go to a planetarium, and I've gone, and you look up, it's like, oh, look, it's Jupiter, right? And it's moons, right? It looks wonderful. And can you land on it? No. Why not? Well, it's just some light on the ceiling. It looks pretty realistic, but it's still a light on the ceiling. Question is, when you walk out of that building, who's to say you're not in a much, much bigger building? Now, take that perspective and then imagine you bring in, I don't know, an Amish person that has no exposure, even more than Amish, right? Maybe even person, an old Amish, someone from the 1800s. We'll go back in time for a little bit. And you take them to that same planetarium, you'll blow their minds. Because they're looking up the sky. It's like, how do you get the moon to move so fast? And wow, there's just all these different things. They don't know because they've never seen anything like it. You know, we're just kind of used to it because of the level of our technology. But we're kind of getting to that point now, especially with virtual stuff, that we can create stuff in the sky. It's very, very, very realistic. But who's to say that the beings or whatever you want to call it that built this place didn't have access to technology? Imagine what we could do if we didn't kill each other and lived, another 1,000 years. as a civilization, what could we come up with?
So where does NASA come into all this? As from what I understand, your views on their organization aren't entirely positive.
No. It's not that I hate them, but I don't, because I don't blame them for what they did. They did what they had. Remember the greater good that I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
NASA did what they had to do because they had to do it. And I probably would have done the same thing. So if you figure out in 1955, 56, during Operation Deep Freeze, that the world is indeed a snow globe, what do you do? Well, it's like, okay, we got to figure out the boundaries of this place for one. And we got to figure out the dimensions of it. And the second thing we got to do is we have to militarize space. We can't let private companies go up there and just start mucking about. Because once they do, eventually they're going to start crashing into things and we're not going to be able to explain it. You have to control the information. So faking a space program, brilliant, absolutely brilliant idea. And I applaud them for doing it. The way they did it wasn't great. It started out fairly small. You know, NASA was founded in 1958. But they did two things. They announced the Van Allen radiation belts in 1959, which said that, oh, yeah, there's these super, super thick, huge, horrible belts of radiation. You'll kill anyone that goes through it. That didn't go well. That was poorly timed. And then in the same year is when the Antarctic Treaty was put in place. So coincidentally, you lock down the outer rim and put a big warning sign on the upper part. And that solves two of your big problems right there, which is, okay, well, no one's going to go to Antarctica anyway because it's such a hostile environment. It just, again, screams go away. I think that was part of the design of this place. But then you start creating this, the thought about the space race was, you create a fake space race and then you make it seem like it's so boring and there's nothing else to see that you just shut the whole thing down a few years later, which is what they did. Don't forget, the Americans supposedly went, like, what, six times back and forth to the moon. And then in 1972, he said, well, nobody cares anymore. And let's just pack it up. Good night, everybody. Roll credits. And that was it. Nobody ever went back again. And, the Soviets, remember, it was supposed to be a space race. I've never seen that, by the way, in the history of anything. Where these two rivals and the United States gets there first and the Soviet Union just walks off the field? That's it? It's like, no. They would have gone there. They would have put up a small base. And we would have put up a bigger base. And then eventually Time magazine would have said, has the Cold War reached the moon? That's how it would have gone. But no, the Soviet Union just quietly faded off into nothing in terms of the space stuff. It was just staggering to me. And then any other country, nobody decided to go back. I remember having a discussion. I was over there a couple of years ago in your neck of the woods, and I was talking to some science people in Belfast. And I said, and I asked them, I said, so, the Americans went to the moon in 1972. I go, when are we going back? Anyone, doesn't matter if these Americans are not. And this woman looked at me with the most sincere eyes, and she had to be half my age. And she goes, soon, we're going back soon. And I go, yeah, you see, you've been telling the science community this for a long, long time now. There's a compilation out there. Every president on our side, from Reagan, right, all the way through to, past Trump, Biden doesn't talk about it, they've all said the same thing. We're committed to going back to the moon. And they just keep kicking that can down and kicking that can down. Nothing ever happens. The only thing they got is the space station, and the production value inside that space station is horrifyingly bad. Horrible. It's just the mistakes they made, even a C-list director in Hollywood would never, ever make. And I don't know who they're hiring, but they should all be fired.
NASA has actually released photographs of the Earth from space and the Earth from the moon and so on. Which all show the Earth as a globe. Am I to assume then that NASA spends their budget on faking those photographs?
Well, they spend a lot of their money on other stuff because their budget is 50, I think as of this year, it's $54, $55 million a day. I don't know what they're spending that sort of cash on, but it's not the faking stuff. As a matter of fact, the blue marble shot, which you speak of, again, the general public, they just gloss over things, and general public doesn't know, especially Americans. We don't know anything when we graduate from high school, so especially nothing about engineering or physics or chemistry or biology. But when it comes to the blue marble shot, you could look this up. This will tell you how I couldn't even see the forest for the trees back in the day. In 2000, when I was running a tech support team on Boulder, Colorado for the time and attendance thing, I thought, oh, it'd be kind of cool if I put different shots of the Earth. I was a huge science nerd. Put different shots of the Earth on every monitor, right? And I had world maps and I had globes. I used to collect antique globes. Not kidding you. It makes me like, wow, you're a really interesting and same time boring person. But it's true. I was doing this. And so I was looking online for different pictures of the Earth from space, doing all sorts of Boolean searches on it. There was only one image that was coming up time and time and time again. That was the Apollo 17 blue marble shot. It was the only image out there. In fact, I remember looking, you know, these internet searches, and I just had screen after screen of nothing but this image in different resolutions, and the tint was bad. And I remember yelling at the computer, I go, NASA, you suck. It's like, what the hell is wrong with you guys? It's like, release some more pictures, right? In fact, Al Gore, one of our vice presidents, did the same thing. Called him up. It's like, look, do you have any? He goes, I want a globe for my back wall in my office. Do you have any newer shots? No, we don't. So 1972 was the first blue marble shot ever taken. You know when the second one was taken? 2015. Summer of 2015. That's when the second blue marble, 43 years. 43 years, you didn't have a second full disc shot of the Earth. In fact, the first one didn't show America. You would have thought Americans, you would have shown them. No, it showed one continent continent in its entirety, which was Antarctica, of all things, and then the bottom part of Africa. Brilliant, because two birds with one stone. It's like, oh yeah, that's what Antarctica looks like. They went out of their way to do that, but no blue marble shot had been taken. I mean, that's most of the 70s, all of the 80s, all of the 90s, all of 2000, 2010, and halfway to 2015, amazing. Absolutely amazing they could get away. And the reason why they didn't do it is because they were scared to death of faking that. It's better to fake interior shots of different things like a space station. Sorry, my voice was...
So are there photographs in existence of what the Earth actually looks like, as in a flat Earth with a dome? Do these exist anywhere?
No, there aren't. As a matter of fact, if you want to look up a great shot... Excuse me. A great shot would be the blue marble. In fact, it's not even the blue marble. It's the Rob Simmons first. I don't know when you got your first iPhone, but the very first model of the iPhone had a blue marble type shot. It was a picture of the Earth on it. The problem was there were no shots of the Earth. But, you know, in fact, they had to hire a NASA engineer to Photoshop and build one from scratch. And he's done interviews. He says, oh, yeah, I built the whole thing in Photoshop. In fact, he got, I don't know why, and I'm dying to ask him if I ever run into him, because the problem was in the Southern Hemisphere, when you look at that, he just used the cloning tool on the clouds. Just like, it was like he had to finish it on a Friday and it'd go to happy hour or something, because there were just tons and tons of clone clouds in the bottom. And we can see this. And then when I went to the Houston Space Center some years later, I saw Rob Simmons' shot on the wall at this NASA facility, and there was no caption underneath it. I knew exactly what it was. You know, we've stared at it many, many times. In fact, I pointed it out to the documentary team. I go, look, here's the cloning tool in the Southern Hemisphere. You know, I know exactly who built it. I know what he built it in. And yet NASA's got it sitting here like it's an actual shot of the Earth. And the documentary team wouldn't touch it, wouldn't even comment. Like, whatever. So.
Interesting.
There you go. So, no, there are no shots. There are high altitude shots of the Earth. Yes, but not far enough to where you can actually see the whole Earth. There just aren't, which is why, because you can't get that far. You can't get that far. Plus, it doesn't look like that. You know, this is why the blue marble shots between 1 and 2, there was 43 years apart. And in fact, I wouldn't even have noticed, except that Obama was the one that tweeted the second blue marble shot. And Scott Kelly, an astronaut, he was the one that wrote the press release, supposedly from the space station. It's like, oh, my God, it just drove me nuts. By the way, Scott Kelly, the fact that he was in that documentary, miracle. Producers said, we have no idea why he said yes. In fact, we only talked to him for 5 minutes. He sat down. He delivered exactly. He apparently knew the lines before, you know, even the question was there. And he knew exactly what to say, because that was the line that was used in the trailers, which was that the first time I heard about flat Earth was when I was in the space station, when I was in space. It's like, it was a brilliant line, which immediately discredits. It's like, well, I'm an astronaut. I'm here to tell you it's not flat because I was in space. It's like, whatever.
So anyway. I guess by the same measure, there's little or no photographs of like the Arctic wall and the edges of the Earth plate then, I'm guessing.
No, why would there be? I mean, this is the best secret, best kept secret in the history of us. You know, this is something you don't tell people. And yes, there are secrets that can be hidden. Compartmentalization, that's easy. There's some people who come back and say, no, this is so big that you can't keep it a secret. It's like, no. This is so big, you have to keep it a secret. In fact, this isn't like the Manhattan Project where you're refining uranium and you're building an atomic weapon in secret where you have 100,000 people that really don't know what's going on because they're all just working on their little piece. No, this is something where less is better. You just don't tell. You don't want as few people going down there as possible, you know, down to Antarctica. It's only like 5,000 people down there at any given time, most of them military or military scientists. Nobody owns Antarctica, which is brilliant. You know, find me another piece of real estate in the world that isn't owned by someone. If you want to go down there and do your own expedition, you have to apply for a massive amount of permits from multiple countries. And by the way, by the time you're done doing that, they know exactly where you are. And the GPS system, if you're going to use that while you're down there, it's going to take you exactly where it wants to take you. Everything, and they've had years and years and years to refine this. Back in 1960, when they first figured it out, the general public wasn't really exploring stuff. The internet wasn't even close to being built yet. There was no social media. There were no smartphones. You had some limited television, newspaper, and radio. So information moved pretty slow. And over the last 5-6 decades, they refined their process to where now they've got multiple layers of barriers in your way to stop you from figuring this out.
There was that a Norwegian group. I think there was 2 or 3 sailors, quite a young group, who tried to get to Antarctica. I don't know if you heard about this, about 10 years ago now. And I think that they were boarded and arrested and put in jail just for trying to get to Antarctica. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I think it was Jarl Vandehoy. Was that his name, I believe?
Something like that. I'm not very good with Norwegian language, but yeah, something
like that.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It was a weird name. Yeah, because if you don't apply for the permits, you can get in a lot of trouble. It's like, why would you get in a lot of trouble? It's very strict what's down there. And I know some people over the years, including me, you know, said, well, there's an Antarctic Defense Force, but they don't have to. You know, our radar and detection abilities, if you see someone even getting close to that thing, you can kind of wave them off. Plus, they've enhanced the treaty over the years. Now you can't even, there's, like with boats, you can't do stuff below like the 60th parallel. And back, like, and then I think it was the beginning of 2017, they banned drones from Antarctica. It's like, why would you ban drones? And some people's like, well, it's because of the natural resource and the environmental issues, right? It's an environmental treaty. It's like, no. I mean, the treaty was built before environmentalism was even a word. I mean, remember, Greenpeace didn't even fire up until the 70s. So why would you lock this thing down in the 50s when we were all about exploring everything? It's good stuff, though.
How big is the Flat Earther movement now? It seems to be a grown belief system online, and I understand that following the Netflix documentary that we spoke about several times earlier, that your fan base, or followers, if you like, have grown exponentially.
Oh, it's massive. It's absolutely massive. The problem, it's a blessing and a curse, because 90% of our members are in the closet. I know this because a lot of them emailed me. It's like, yeah, I'm totally with you. Yeah, I'm not coming out. We're not talking about this. I have talked with people in industry. I have talked to celebrities. Talked to also, in fact, Kyrie Irving, as much as he helped us, you know, our big NBA basketball star over here.
Yeah.
When he came out about it, it celebrities, when they come out, it hurts them. Because the knee-jerk reaction. Look up the headlines. I could send. In fact, maybe I'll post one for you real fast. Hang on. The in your neck of the woods, I will give you real quick here.
Yeah, I understand it is a UK-based Flat Earth Society.
There's a huge UK contingent. Here's one for you. I'll drop this little newspaper clipping in the thing for you, which is Freddie Flintoff. Right. Ex-cricket guy, you know, over here, we don't know what cricket is. We just turned it into baseball. Cricket is actually way more of an interesting game. Baseball is just not even tolerable without some beer. It's just not. But Freddie Flintoff, he comes out, and that's the headline. You know, it's like Freddie Flat Earth. You know, he's the, you know, anyone gets made fun of. Kyrie Irving, the only reason he came out was because he had already had his championship. He had shoe contracts. He was friends with LeBron James. He was making millions of dollars in his 20s, and he felt he had nothing to lose. Well, you know, trophies, you know, the luster starts fading after a while. And the journalists, they're merciless. They don't forget this stuff. They're gonna keep hammering on them time and time again. I have talked to celebrities like, yeah, there's no way we're gonna do what we saw. What happened to Kyrie? Kyrie was made the example of. So there are millions. Absolutely. In fact, here's one for you. I'll show you a real cool thing. So you could punch this up on you. I don't know if you have a laptop or whatever. You don't need the app for this, which is we eventually made our own app. And on this app, we just launched maybe 4 weeks ago, something called a Flat Earth Friend Finder. So you activate, you can turn on, you know, it's like, well, Flat Earthers, you know, friends that are alive in your area. And you punch that up. And you know, I think out of the 100,000 people that were just on this app, I think 25,000 and change, 26,000 have turned on their locators. And again, that's just one small app out of all the people. There are millions. Absolutely.
Oh, we'll put that on the blog on our website so anyone listening can check that out. And
yeah, zoom in. I mean, the UK presence is huge. Basically, any English-speaking country were the ones that got into it big. United States, UK, Canada, of course, Australia, New Zealand, a bunch of Europe, not as much in France for some reason. Eastern Bloc countries, very, very cool. I mean, we're all over the place.
So I guess one final question from me then, Mark, is that if you've got only one opportunity to sell your flat earth theory to someone, what would you say to convince them that your theory is true?
I would tell them the same thing that how I started with the flat earth clues, which was, I'm not here to convince you or persuade you. I'm just here to pose the question, which is like, don't believe a word I've said, and, you know, take everything you've heard here with a grain of salt. Do your own research and figure it out. We have a 99% retention rate. That's higher than basically any organized religion, as far as I can tell, which is because I'm not the one to convince you. You have to convince yourself. You know, do your own research and ask questions. And once you do, if you're the one that tore down the globe yourself, the reason why we have such a high retention rate is, how can you, it's kind of like the Matrix thingy, right? Red pill, blue pill. Once you're out of the Matrix, how do you go back in? You can't, because you were the one that left voluntarily. If you abandon the globe and get into the whole snow globey thing, why would you ever go back? How could you go back? So, which is why I have to put a warning to anyone that might be listening, which is like, and this is not reverse psychology. It is absolutely not. If you like your way, you know, way it is right now, if you think you got a good bead on things and you wake up every day, you know, thumbs up, everything is awesome, don't do it. Don't look into flat earth. I'm warning you, because once you do, you will, you know, eventually you'll get to this moment where you can't turn back. There'll be this moment where it's like, holy crap, you know, you've gone too far and you can't go back. And then next thing you know, you'll be emailing me. It's like, you wrecked my life in a good way. But at the same time, you'll miss some of the other stuff. You know, ignorance is bliss. So
Mark, I have to say, I have huge amounts of respect to anyone who fights for what they believe in, even when it goes against the so-called accepted narrative. Past scientific pioneers such as Galileo, Albert Einstein, Alan Turing, Michael Servetus, and Mohammad Reza's, to name just a few, were all persecuted for the advances in science that they discovered and tried to bring to prominence. So I applaud you for doing the same. Thanks for your time tonight, Mark. For those of you who would like to hear more from Mark Sargent and his Flat Earth theories, check out his YouTube channel at youtube.com/MarkKSargent. And also be sure to check out his documentary on Netflix. It's called Behind the Curve, and it is fantastic. Mark, thanks again.
Thank you.
Mark raised some interesting points there and held some pretty strong and thought-provoking beliefs. And as Mark touched on his theory that Flat Earth was being kept from the people of the world by a large global conspiracy, I'm going to focus on that just until the end. Conspiracy. So did Hillary Clinton mastermind a global child trafficking ring from a Washington, D.C. pizzeria? No, of course not. Did Joe Biden and the Democrat Party orchestrate a plot to commit widespread voter fraud in the 2019 U.S. election? Again, no. So why do some people believe that they did? And what makes so many people believe in conspiracies, no matter how outlandish that they may sound? Conspiracy theories are not a new phenomenon. Far from it, actually. They've been a continual part of our culture for more than 100 years. And they are certainly more widespread than you may have considered. In a quote from Professor Joe Uzinski that I took from his book titled American Conspiracy Theories, he says, and I quote, "Everybody believes in at least one and probably a few. And the reason simple, there is an infinite number of conspiracy theories out there. If we were to poll on all of them, everybody is going to check at least a few boxes." These comments, although regarding the United States, do not solely apply to that nation. Most British citizens also tick at least one box when presented with a list of just five conspiracy theories. And I found that in a 2015 Cambridge University study, the same also applied to such nations such as Canada, the Netherlands, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Ireland, Norway, and Russia. The conspiracies presented to each group range from there is a secret all-powerful group that secretly run the world, such as the Illuminati, that the Earth is flat, that world governments have been in contact with extraterrestrials for decades and keep it from the masses, the President John F. Kennedy was not killed by the lone gunman Lee Harvey Oswald, and that the moon landings were faked in a United States movie studio. I must admit that I myself would fall into the category of conspiracy believers. As regular listeners of this show will know, I'm a firm believer that JFK was murdered as part of a wider conspiracy. There's a ton of evidence to support it, people, but that's another episode. But contrary to popular belief, the typical conspiracy theorist is not a middle-aged man living in his mother's basement sporting a tinfoil hat. That's the unfortunate false narrative applied to conspiracy theorists by detractors. When you actually look at the demographic data, belief in conspiracies cuts across social class, it cuts across gender, it spans the political spectrum, and it even cuts across age. Whether you're on the political left or the right, you're just as likely to see plots against you. To understand why we are so drawn to the notion of shadowy forces controlling political events, we need to think about the psychology behind conspiracy theories. We are very good at recognizing patterns and irregularities, but sometimes we overanalyze them. We think we see meaning and significance when it isn't really there. This is basic human psychological function. We also assume that when something happens, it happens because someone or something made it happen for a reason. The average person's psyche accepts reason, understanding, and motive far easier than chaos. It is why we find macabre crimes with no clear motive more chilling. It's also the basis for most religious foundations, with the existentialist thought of no meaning to life and nothing after death extremely unpalatable to most. Additionally, we see coincidences around big events, and we then make up a story around them or fill in the blanks regarding the parts of the story we don't know or understand. That story will become a conspiracy theory because it contains good guys and bad guys, the latter being responsible for all things that make us uncomfortable. Like blaming politicians, for example. We often blame politicians for bad events, even when those events are beyond their control. People will blindly reward or punish the government for good or bad times without really having any clear understanding of whether or how the government's policies have contributed to those outcomes, if they have at all. You don't have to go far to see evidence of this. Just take the Trump presidency, for example. It divided the United States population like never before, and multiple conspiracy theories emerged from it. As part of my psychology degree in university, I conducted extensive research into the conspiracy theories that people believe, and it's quite staggering the number of quite outlandish theories that some people will believe with every ounce of their self, while still acknowledging that it may make no scientific sense. It may not be terribly positive to learn that conspiracy theories are deeply embedded in political thinking. It's often the case that we are constructing our beliefs in ways that support what we don't want to be true. Often, a rebuttal of conspiracy theories will be for an individual to obtain more information on the subject, although this is of little help. The people who are most subject to these biases or theories are the very people who are paying the most attention. In the end, we want to feel comfortable, not be correct, we want to know answers, but not spend hours reading and researching. It is why particular conspiracy theories come and go, but also why conspiracy will always be part of the stories we tell about larger popular events. None of this is to rebuke the information that Mark Sargent shared with us tonight, of course, nor is it meant to discredit him or his theories in any way. But I guess for me, I need that smoking gun evidence to be able to agree with the flat earth theory, and I have that with the current scientific spherical earth belief. That aside though, if hard evidence to the contrary ever emerged, I would certainly be the first to analyse it. Thanks for sharing your theories with us tonight, Mark. We at Dead Souls Social Club wish you the very best with your journey of discovery. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our newsletter over at deadsoulsocialclub.com. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company, media, or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deadsoulsocialclub.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. Until next time, everyone, stay safe and sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.